Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
I suspended twice, and the third time it was kind of, technically I'm not sure whether I was or not, because I was summoned in by the then director of news. I said to him, I presume you wanted to suspend me before 1 o'clock. And he said, So I said, right.
Well, Mary, here we are again. I have to say, I'm getting some very nice summer vibes now. The flowers.
The stretch in the evening.
The stretch in the evening, the bright blue skies. Yeah. Out and about, meeting people.
Where exactly are you living?
Yeah. Greece.
Doesn't sound like anywhere close to me, but I do like the stretch in the evening, the summer stretch. Mm-hmm.
And the colours. And the colours.
And the vibrancy. Yeah.
And I think it's a lovely time to get out and about and to meet up with friends. And on the subject of friendship, I have the privilege of introducing a woman who's not only a former colleague of mine, but also a very dear friend. And it's Anne Doyle, whose journey began in rural Ireland. And you won't recognise yourself with this fabulous introductory paragraph. Your passion for storytelling and innate curiosity ignited a flame that would actually shape her destiny. She was born in Ferns in County Wexford, and Anne's upbringing instilled in her a deep appreciation for the power of words and the responsibility of sharing them with the world. And from a groundbreaking appointment as the first woman newsreader on RTE's flagship evening news programme to her iconic presence during some of our country's most historic moments, Anne's voice became synonymous with credibility, integrity and trust. But beyond the headlines and the accolades, which are all well deserved, lies the Anne Doyle that I have come to know and admire, a woman of huge kindness, wisdom and wit. And you're very welcome to Alan Wood, Anne.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
You actually didn't expect to end up in television. You were a teacher for a while, you were a librarian, you worked in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and then the television beckoned.
Yep, I was a most unlikely candidate, that's for sure. I suppose I must have felt some draw of the glamour of television. I don't remember feeling like that, to be honest. And I was easily led, I suppose. And it was the era where the job was actually advertised. And so somebody suggested to me that I apply. And I think I thought it would be easy, you know. That's a terrible thing to say, but I do have a memory of thinking that, sure, you just sit around and read a bit of stuff.
It didn't end up like that, did it?
Oh, Lord, no, it did not indeed. And that was one of the greatest mistakes I ever made. But obviously, in the end, mistake or not, it was, I suppose, what has shaped most of my life. But I was not a natural for television. I think I simply got more enthusiastic as the whittling down process went on, because it went from, you know, a very large number of people down to, say, 20 and then 10. And then I think half a dozen of us were brought in on a so-called training course. And at this stage, I was absolutely delighted. I thought, this is fantastic. Look how far I've come. And I really lost sight of the fact maybe that if I did get the job, I had no idea what it would be like or whether I would be any good at it or whether I'd even want to be any good at it. But by the time I got the job, I had it and I had given up my good job at the civil service. And that was that.
You have been renowned always, and I have always admired your on-screen presence, your calm demeanour. But, you know, a lot of people won't realise that you always had nerves.
Mary, I was only frozen to the seat with fear. That's what kept me calm. I was afraid to flinch in case the whole facade crumbled. No, I did my best. But yes, I always had stage fright. I was always very nervous. And that lovely, kind way that you described me, well, doesn't sound a bit like me.
When you were doing the news, all those years that we associate you with big stories, were there any particular story? Because you just said, you know, that sometimes it's, you know, it's not always happy news. It's very rarely happy news. Were there stories that really got to you, that you took home with you and you couldn't sleep at night over the head of?
It would have been probably more periods of time,
right?
You know, rather than a particular story. What was, I suppose, very interesting for me when I came to realise, I mean, when I started in the newsroom, I remember thinking very clearly, this is definitely not for me. It's frightening the life out of me. But I didn't really have an option of another job at the time. But when I managed to steady myself and look around me, what was very interesting was to see the whole process of how news came together, because I didn't know anything about it. So when you're at home and you see somebody, you know, presenting a news bulletin, and it all looks easy peasy, and it's just, there you go. And I had no idea that it was such a big and such a complex operation. I had no idea there would be so many people involved. I had no idea that there would be so much hard work involved for people, and that there would be so many people, particularly, I think, on the technical side, with remarkable expertise. I've found, you know, in my early years, we had, let's call it a manned studio, a personed studio, and the studio crews that I had the pleasure of working with were by far the most interesting people I met in RTE. They had all kinds of interesting backgrounds. A lot of people had theatrical backgrounds. A lot of them were technically extremely skilled in what they actually did in RTE was probably the least taxing of what they were capable of doing. And then the whole process of the gathering of news, which was, you know, again, it seems so archaic now, but in those days it was, you know, the wires rolling in. There was a lot of paper. There were a lot of rolls, and the wire room with the stuff slammed on the wall, you know, a copy taster going through it. And everything being checked and counter-checked. And sometimes there were mistakes. Sometimes there are.
Were there days of disaster? Because you're live in studio. You weren't doing pre-recorded stuff that you could edit.
No, and I'm always a little edgy. Well, see, obviously I'm always a little edgy, full stop. But very rarely did I do anything on RTE that was recorded. What many people would, I think, regard as the luxury of recording. It wasn't for me. I never could focus the same way. I always felt that I'd make mistakes if I were recording. I didn't usually, but I just felt that, because the other way, you just have, that's
you
it.
Have to.
You know.
You get one shot at it.
There you go. It's done.
But you're live in studio. I remember many, many years ago when I was working on Current Affairs and doing a live programme, and you're supposed to be looking at the autocue, but in those days the autocue wasn't attached to the camera. And so you're supposed to be looking at the camera through the autocue, and the autocue was sitting in front of me and the camera took off in the opposite direction. And I remember not having a clue where I was supposed to look.
Where do you go?
And realising everybody at home is watching this. And it seems, in the scheme of things, it's a small thing, but on live television,
it looks
desperate.
Absolutely terrifying.
It's terrifying. Mm-hmm.
And it did, obviously, in a way, technology made it a great deal easier, because when you're in studio, you could access what was going on. I always more or less from the beginning, from as soon as I was able to, I always had my earpiece open. Some people found that very distracting. I didn't.
Would you be listening to instructions?
I would be listening to everything. Yeah. I'd be listening to one very dear news director who would be discussing knitting patterns in woman's way, etc.
In the middle of the news.
Sometimes things are just rolling along.
Nicely.
You know, and that Mammy made a great lentil stew and that kind of thing. It could be a bit disconcerting if you were feeling a bit, you know, you can understand why sometimes you felt a bit nervous. But yeah, so you, at least you knew what was going on out there. And also then later on, you had your little laptop or whatever. Mm, so, of course, you know, it did often give you fair warning of where things were going or what might be coming at you. And after that, there's always the power of prayer. And there were Hail Marys and more colourful stuff too.
You have always been renowned for, and I have always admired, your screen presence, Anne. Was that something that just came naturally to you?
Would that be fear, Mary?
No. Do you know what's interesting about it was? It was very obvious to the person viewing that you were very conscious of the fact that it wasn't about you. You were the kind of the facilitator of the news.
Well, that is very important to me, and thank you. I started in a world of news presentation where that was what was expected of you. And so I was fortunate to have worked with people like Don Coburn, who I would have regarded as a wonderful, wonderful news presenter. He was diffident to a point that was astonishing in his own charming way. But when he looked at the camera, you believed him.
Mm-hmm. Completely. I think people believed you too.
He was very quiet. He was, you know, very gentle in his delivery, but you believed him. And it was never about Don Coburn.
No, he didn't stand in the way of the story. No. And neither did you. Ever, ever, ever. Which you couldn't say about everybody.
Well, there's not an awful lot of room, really, for pushing yourself forward. I mean, if anybody has any interest in listening to what you're saying, and if they have no interest in listening to what you're saying, then they will switch you off. Or you shouldn't be doing the job.
When you'd go home in the evening after doing the news, 9 o'clock news, and the stories, some of the stories would have broken your heart nice, because not all that often would you be dealing with really good news, as the truth, isn't it? I mean, it was...
No,
because that's the nature of news. And sometimes you're bringing stories to people that you know are going to crush them. They could crush a neighbourhood, they could crush a family, they could even crush the world. They were so miserable. How did you switch off when you go home? Could you switch that off?
Well, I didn't really, I suppose, because don't forget that with the exception of, if you'll pardon me putting it in this rather inelegant way, one-off disasters, but most pretty tragic news stories are ongoing. I mean, there would wars,
Northern Ireland,
famine. Northern Ireland was one that was very close to my own heart. I had a lot of family connections there, and I spent a lot of time there. I was up and down to Belfast a lot, and that really haunted me. I think for me, the saddest time that I recall, and you know, and we had then with the boom and bust and all of that, and the ghastly situation for so many people in Ireland. But I think the hunger strikes for me were the saddest time. It seemed so hopeless, and Ireland seemed to be in such a hopeless place. You just couldn't see any way around it. Mm-hmm. And it is astonishing. It would, you know, make sure that you didn't lose all faith in a better future. It is astonishing to see, in that respect, at least how far we've come.
Mm. Isn't it remarkable?
Isn't it?
And indeed also how we have, touch wood, and I realise there are huge problems facing our country, but how far we have advanced from the last boom bust, because that was a terrible, bleak time. I mean, you went to that, that really, I think, was what made my mind up that I was kind of done with news. You know, every day you went in and there was a new catastrophe, and people were losing their homes and their businesses were going wallop. And it was just, it was a dreadful time. So it never went away, really.
And Anne, you chose to take early retirement.
Oh, well, no, Mary, it wasn't that early.
It was early enough.
I shaved in under 60, but not by much.
Yeah, but like that was a big decision to make.
It wasn't
to
really.
To step away.
Why wasn't it such a big decision?
I felt I'd had enough. Sometimes you've had enough and maybe you just, you know, I know this sounds rather precious because it's a job is a job and a very handy thing and very glad to get paid. But sometimes you just feel you've nothing much left to give. You can still do it. I did a lot of radio, which I liked. And in my last few years, I was doing the 9 o'clock news. Before that, I used to do the 1 o'clock as well, which was very punishing. But in between, I was doing an awful lot of radio headlines. Lyric at that stage, I think, on the half hour. Radio 1 on the hour, more or less. Mm-hmm. That has been pruned back now. Mm-hmm. It was onerous. I mean, I used to come in and I used to go to makeup for 9 o'clock. Before 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. It was the only time that I had free to go to makeup.
Wow. Mm.
Unless I didn't watch the 6-1 news and that would be too dangerous.
Yeah.
So, you know, it became kind of crushing in a slightly monotonous way. And when you start feeling like that, I think, plus also, I think I was very lucky. An opportunity came along or the hint of an opportunity. And, you know, in those days, it was going to be a 65 cut off anyway. And I thought it would be good to get out a little bit on the early side. And I didn't really give it an awful lot of thought.
Did you think about, well, what am I going to do now with my time?
I was afraid to think about that, Mary. I hope that I was diligent in my approach to work. But I would not say that I was imbued with a deep love of the idea of going to work every day. I'm quite good at dossing, you know? So I thought I'd be okay. I mean, I would imagine it was more challenging for me to think for the 40 years or whatever that I was working. It was more challenging for me to think, how am I going to go to work every day? There are challenges to that too. Sometimes I don't know what to do with myself. I used to walk a lot, which I think is, you know, is good for the head and good for the body.
And are you involved in community stuff?
Yeah.
You are.
I am, and I enjoy that.
I'm actually interested in how you cope with these kinds of questions. And people ask, well, what do you do now in your retirement? And you very honestly and very candidly say, well, actually, I quite like doing nothing. There are people who kind of wear busyness and being involved in all sorts of things as a badge of honour. But you're quite happy in
I never was a hugely busy person. I remember, I think, what would have been the busiest time of my life, which was when I ran for the RTE authority. And so, you had to run a campaign.
As an internal member of staff, as a staff rep?
Staff rep. Mm. And so, you know, you had an election campaign, basically. And you canvassed and you were assisted by your well-meaning and deluded friends who thought it would be a good idea.
And were there many other candidates?
I've forgotten entirely how many, but there were quite a few, I remember. There were.
You won, though, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
You did.
But that was probably the busiest time of my life in that I was working all day, yes, every day as
why
well.
Why did you want to be on the authority, though?
I'm going to sound, quite rightly, like the most shocking wimp. I suspect Geraldine Harney suggested to me, do you not think? And also, I think there was an element of my being involved in a certain amount of conflict with some of the senior managers. It was an ongoing sort of conflict. It was very healthy for both sides. Mm. We were good for each other, I hope. But it occurred to me that it might be an interesting position of strength if I were on the board.
Was it?
it changed things. Credit to the people with whom I was locking horns. they didn't back down completely, but they tended maybe to keep a little more space.
But you didn't. You never shied away from, you know, doing that, from taking on.
No, what you mean is you were bloody difficult, Anne.
No.
Were you
actually suspended once for passing
twice for sure, and I have a feeling.
Yeah. What got you suspended?
You wouldn't pass the picket.
It was actually just that I was always on the next news. You know, so it, the 1 o'clock, would, for example, might be, the crooks. And then you are supposed to go in and do the bulletin, and a management crew would, or wannabe crew in some cases, would run the
Mandy,
run
yeah.
the desk. And so you didn't. I was suspended twice. And the third time, it was kind of, technically, I'm not sure whether I was or not, because I was summoned in by the then director of news, who was a man who didn't care for me, nor I for him. But he was oddly shy about the whole business. I'm standing there, it's about 12:45, you know, so I'm thinking, you better get this over with. And eventually I said to him, I presume you wanted to suspend me before 1 o'clock. And he said, So I said, right. So I suppose I suspended myself, in a manner of speaking, because I had visions of still standing there at 1 o'clock, and it really got to work out very well.
I see a lot of people listening to this who knew you from all those years when you appeared in television, and you're always magnificently dressed,
correct,
beautifully turned out, the hair perfect, the makeup perfect, the very calm and confident and credible presentation. And they're saying, God, actually behind that, there was a bit of an Isle Rebel.
Oh, I should hope so. I am a proud Wexford woman.
Of course.
Yeah, actually, we must go back and talk about your
upbringing.
You grew up in Ferns. Big family.
Yeah, there were seven of us. I was the youngest. I grew up in a townland of Coolator, which would be about halfway between the village of Ferns and Boulevogue, which is where my father's people were from. I grew up in a nationalist family, which wouldn't have been unusual, mm-hmm, either of the time or of the place, and always with an awareness, perhaps a somewhat exaggerated idea, of our particular importance in Irish history.
Absolutely, Boulevogue down the road. Was it a happy childhood?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. I mean, like most of our neighbours, we would have had no money, really. Mm. There was an element of not quite self-sufficiency, but, you know, people ate what they grew, really. And, of course, for my mother, because it would have been a very traditional, my father worked, my mother kept the house, and with a house full of children, she would have had a lot to do, and everything was done by hand. Mm. Everything. I mean, I was nine, I think, when we got electricity. When I was growing up, there was no washing machine, so you can imagine. It was a tin bath and, a bag of blue, for anybody who remembers blue.
What was the blue for? Tell them.
For white, to make white.
To make things white.
That wasn't used all that often either. It was tough for people, you know, digging spuds. My mother was blessed with having an extraordinarily happy nature. She was just a very sunshiny person. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing called comfort farmish about it at all. I could see how there could have been.
I love the story of how you were brought home from boarding school when she fell off a table in the middle of papering.
Oh, my God.
What was she, wallpapering?
She was wallpapering. She broke her wrist. And
she did everything.
I was dispatched. And that was the only time that I was ever in the what would have been the traditional girl's role in the family. Because there wasn't... My mother wasn't really like that. She didn't think along very structured lines, and also she wouldn't have had time, she had too much work to do. Mm-hmm. So I was dispatched home to take up the reins of the hard labour, and I think I was there for about 3 to 4 weeks. I was there for the Easter holidays, a little bit early, and maybe a week after. Mm-hmm. It nearly killed me. And I mean, I was about 14, and I would have been very fit and healthy.
And is that the time when you realised that you would not become a domestic goddess?
I couldn't wait
to not be.
Oh my God. I did go through a period in my life where I sort of toyed with, I was never a domestic goddess, but it was in the course of a long and rather unhappy relationship, really. And when it ended, my attempt at domesticity ended. That was, I said, right, that's it. I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm done with dinners. I'm done with whatever. And regrettably, I managed to find food wherever I went. So, I mean, it's not regrettable to find food, but perhaps maybe if I'd been a little less successful at finding it, there'd be a little less of me here.
And your partner today is the cook at home, is he?
Yeah, but we very rarely. I'm in the fortunate position that he has a pub that does food.
A restaurant,
and he cooks
yeah.
there.
You're just, as my mother would say, you're the jammiest, luckiest
yeah,
person imaginable.
I know, I mean, but look, I didn't enjoy it. I did it.
Yeah.
And
but it was a chore.
And it was in that was a relationship where I had, in a way, I suppose the misfortune of being in residence with a man who was actually a very good cook, and all his family were
right.
very good cooks. And he had a couple of uncles who were chefs and all of this. And I remember Christmases I would spend at Belfast and the long discussions about Manani's three kinds of gravy and the three kinds of stuffing, the bread stuffing for the neck of the bird, etc. And
this is the then boyfriend, is it, from Belfast?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, when all that was over, I thought, no more three kinds of stuffing, no more anything.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Your mother sounds like an absolutely wonderful person, and she was very young when she died, Anne. She was 64.
Yeah, she had just
turned. Had she been ill?
No, she had just turned 64. Her birthday was in August, and she died in early September. She died very suddenly. I was in Spain at the time, and when I got word that she was dead, I couldn't get my head around the fact that she had died from an illness. I thought that she must have been, because she cycled everywhere. I thought she must have been knocked down off the bloody bike or something like that. But she just became unwell in the evening, and the next morning she was really unwell, and she got a very vicious pneumonia.
Wow.
And she was dead. They took her to the local hospital, turned around, they sent her to James, and she was dead before she got there.
Can you remember the feelings that you had at the time?
Well, it was really, you know, it was trying to deal with the logistics in the first place, apart from the shock.
To get home.
Yeah, to get home. And it was in the era of, charter flights. So you couldn't just go up to Malaga and get a flight. So if it was maybe go to Madrid, eventually.
What a journey home.
They got me on a flight the next day. And it was dreadful. But I was very concerned for my brothers at home too, because I knew that they would be in a state of complete shock, and so there are funeral arrangements to be made, and now you've got this. Yours truly.
Is your daddy still alive at that
no,
time?
No, he had died a few years before.
Had. And did he die young too?
He had turned 70, but he had for a month or two been in kind of poorish health. And he was a curious man. I think he had lived his life. He was, do you know, an old-fashioned man in the proper sense of that. He lived really in a kind of different, he lived more in the past. He was like somebody from maybe 50 years earlier. And I think when he had reached 70 and his health wasn't great, his strength was beginning to wane. And he just kind of, I think, lost the spirit of wanting to be out and about every day. He just kind of faded away. As a couple, I'm sure they had their difficulties, but they certainly always seemed to get along mm-hmm. very well. Mm-hmm. And they certainly managed to give us a very happy upbringing. So we didn't know that it was tough, really.
Tell us about how you've coped with loss, because you've had to cope. You talked about your mommy and daddy. They both died young, but you also had siblings who died young. How'd you cope with that?
Well, with my sister, I suppose exhaustion probably got me through that, because for the last months of her life, she was in Dublin and she was staying with me and I was working. So
how old was she?
48. So I was so bloody exhausted because I was up most of the night. And I have to say, for that, the good cook boyfriend that I maybe was a little dismissive of, and he also regrettably is no longer with us. He was really wonderful. I mean, he was terrified that she was going to get extremely ill, that she was going to die or whatever. But I mean, he did his best. He mm-hmm. did his best. And
what was she suffering from at that time?
She got bowel cancer.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And this is not in any way to take from the importance of people being very careful of these things. But my sister would have, if you were to take a role model for somebody who would never get bowel cancer, then I think she would have been the woman.
Really?
She didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She was very fit. She was the primary teacher locally. She was a good cook. She grew her own vegetables. She baked her own bread. I'd say her acquaintance with processed food was almost non-existent.
Wow. And yet she got bowel cancer.
I suspect she was a very kind person. And she shouldered a lot for other people with great good cheer. And I've often thought after that she maybe suppressed a lot of stress.
I think, to be honest,
I'm not saying this because she was my sister. We were chalk and cheese. So let's be straight about this. She was too good. Mm. It doesn't do to be too good. That's why I'm practicing.
And she was your only sister.
Yeah. She was very kind.
Was she married? She wasn't married either, was
no,
she?
No, she... I often wondered, why would you wonder whether somebody should marry? She had a pen friend, a Scottish man, whom she simply took up a correspondence with. It was in the era of people having pen friends. And it developed into a sort of romantic relationship. Insofar as she was in Coolator and he was in Coatbridge, but he played the accordion, I remember. So did my mother. But I remember her going off to meet him by stealth to Dublin. I was about 10 and I was brought along.
Oh, you were the cover story.
I was in Gooseberry. and we fabricated some story, which I think I was fairly instrumental in inventing, because it would not have been that. They were, needless to say, separate hotels, etc. It was beyond proper. But we went to meet him and he wanted to marry her. And she chickened out. She couldn't make that leap of leaving. We had spinster aunts whom she was dedicated to and all of that. I often wondered if she'd taken the leap and gone off to Coatbridge and played the accordion or not. Mm. Maybe her life, but hey,
she had
maybe her life. You can say that about anything. But I think she maybe, it, It doesn't do to be too good to too many people.
She had a huge sense of duty, didn't she?
Yes, and she did it with great kindness. She was a very, very gifted teacher. I mean, she really was. She particularly loved Irish. She had gone to school in Falkara.
How did that happen? Good Lord. Yeah. That's a long way off from Wexford.
It's a long way off. She used to go through Strabane. The train went that way then.
What brought her to school in Donegal?
Because she did, it was gone before my time, she did the preparatory scholarship. And there were four colleges in Ireland that you could go to. And if you got a preparatory scholarship, you did 4 years to your leaving cert. Imagine, 4 years. Mm-hmm. And it was assumed that you would not have any difficulty. You would go directly then into teacher training. So she would have gone to Carysfort. Right. So it was a 6 year term. Mm. So she, how Falkara would have been the furthest away. Mm-hmm. But I don't think she would have had particularly good Irish when she went there. I mean, she would have had it
when she finished there, all right.
But she loved it. Yeah. Mm. She absolutely loved it. And her Donegal friends were friends all her life.
Mm-hmm. You must feel the loss of a sister.
It took a while to get my head around the idea. You know, at the time it was just trying to cope with day to day. And then she was gone. And I think for my brothers too, it was a great loss because I, Flipperty Gibbet, was gone in a manner of speaking anyway. But she was, you
living
know,
locally.
Very
yeah.
much part of the family, you know, and she was one of those people who stepped up, you know. And
she probably stepped up too after your mummy and daddy.
I really do believe it doesn't do to be too good. I'm telling you, I keep practicing.
And you also lost a brother.
My brother John died in 2000. He had a very short, sharp illness. He was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in the final stages. And in those days,
there was no treatment.
There was no treatment.
No.
There is now.
Yes.
John died in a little over two months. But I remember standing in the graveyard at my sister's grave, and obviously our parents had died, and then she had died, and John said, "Oh, that's it now, lads. That's us." It was always lads, you know. "That's it, lads. Now we're next now in the firing line." And I said to him, being always a sweet and nice person, mm-hmm. I said to him, "Well, I hope this is going to go in chronological order then, John, you know, because if it does, you're next, pal, and I'm last." And Lord love him, he was next. The rest of us are hanging in extraordinarily well.
Well, you're the picture of health and joy. You certainly are.
Listen, I'm falling apart quietly and slowly, but so what?
What's on the bucket list now? There must be something you want to do that you haven't yet done.
Oh, God, there are lots of things I haven't done. But right now, what I really wish for, actually, at the risk of sounding rather twee, is I wish for good health for people. I don't want to labour the bits falling off, but, you know, there's a time in your life when little difficulties start cropping up. You're lucky if there are only little difficulties. And I'm hoping to get to Kerry soon.
You love Kerry?
And yeah, I haven't been for a long time.
Have you a particular favourite spot in Kerry?
Well, I have a very good friend who lives in Waterville, and it's okay, Anne, I'm not descending upon you, but it's a beautiful place.
It is. Kerry is special.
And I'd like to get back to Donegal as well, which is a wonderful county. And other than that, look, there are days maybe happy and not too good, but okay.
Mm. You'd live with okay, would you?
Yeah, I'd live with okay, do no harm.
And you're a good traveller. You like to travel, don't you?
I do like to travel, yeah. I for one reason or another, I haven't travelled a lot very recently. But, you know, no doubt that will come again.
Boarding school, what was that like?
Well, it wasn't too bad now, to be honest. I've often thought about this after. Not having children myself, it never arose in my life after I had been there myself. But I wonder if I'd had children, would I have sent them to boarding school? I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, I know that the few boarding schools that are left are completely different to what they were like in my day, obviously. But for me, I would obviously have much preferred to have been at home.
Mm.
That being said, I was in Gorey with the Loretta nuns in Gorey, and it was quite a kind place. It was a small school. They're gone now, so they don't have to forgive me for saying, certainly not academically very ambitious, but it was a nice, it had a nice all-round vibe. Mm-hmm. They were interested in sport, which I was used to that, even though I love sport, but not to play, to observe.
But the debating.
The debating, public speaking, you know, they tried to teach us to dance. Oh, dear. No, I'm not Eileen Dunn. No.
There are people who would love to have you on Dancing with the Stars
next
year.
I'm sure they would. Everybody loves a laugh. I'm not averse myself. Not for all the tea in China. But I absolutely admire anybody who does that. I don't know how they do it. And when we went out recently to Dancing with the Stars,
to support
I was a nervous wreck going to look at the people participating. They seemed to be absolutely fine. I just found it quite terrifying. But yeah, boarding school was okay for me. But there were people there that I'd say were quite unhappy.
And as well as being an avid reader, you've got your own book, which came out last autumn, about ghost stories. Have you always had a fascination with the ghosts?
Yeah, I have, I suppose, been interested. You know, again, it was part of, you know, the rural electrification scheme did lay to rest many of the weights that walk the roads.
Yeah,
but as a child, of course, told ghost stories. And my great fear was vampires, terrified of vampires. And I think this was due to the fact that when I first went to the local cinema, the Picture House in Ferns, which was a fantastic breakthrough for me. The brothers were going, you see, I was the youngest. And the first film I saw was The Quiet Man.
No, the very first film.
And the second one was The Brides of Dracula.
Oh, right. Okay.
Frightened the living daylights. Actually, really had a terrible effect on me. It actually made me realise how important it is that people do keep an eye on what children watch.
Are watching.
No, I appreciate a child now would be, generally speaking, a much more sophisticated creature. But this blew my mind completely. And I realised after that it was the first time I realised that the almighty mammy couldn't protect you from everything, because the vampire would get the almighty mammy, who would promptly turn into a vampire. Not only could she not protect you, but she might be the one to sink her fangs into you and off you went. So it scared the living daylights out of me. Really, really frightened me. And then when I was, you know, still in the national school, the teacher used to keep us back in the evening, those of us who were going for scholarship. And when I think back, of course, we hated this. When I think back, I mean, she was extraordinarily kind. I mean, she gave.
She was dedicated.
She was absolutely
and
dedicated.
To you guys,
like,
she
deeply
was
unappreciated by us. I was a couple of miles then to go home, and it would be in the pitch dark. And that was pretty scary. I was never scared of the living, but there were lots of ghosts hither and yonder on that road. You know, there were stories about this bit and that bit and so on. And I used to be petrified.
Back in then, and also in your parents' time, would people have gathered in the evening, like before there was television, would they have gathered in the evening to tell ghost stories? Because that's how I remember my grandparents' house in Roscommon.
Yeah.
That was the entertainment. It was to frighten the out of you.
Yeah, we aced fear, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But you see, especially if your big family, it's only really when you're on your own that you're scared witless. You know, there was a kind of a you know, that comfort of, oh, I'm really frightened, but we're all here. The vampire finished me with that, you see. I realised then that I had no defence. I used to sleep like that.
And where did the idea for the book about ghost stories come from?
Well, it wasn't my idea. I seem to have gone through life really rambling around. And if somebody said to me, what do you think? a chap who was working for Gill at the time was talking to me about various things. And I somehow or other got into telling him a ghost story. And he said to me, well, did you ever think about ghost stories? And I said to him, there's absolutely no way I am, you know, the fan of Kitty the Hare, etc. There's no way I could write a book of ghost stories. He said, but would you compile one? Say, have a look at Irish ones. Which I thought was a doddle. I said, this sounds fabulous. Because all I have to do is, I said to him, this would involve a lot of reading, I presume. And he said, oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah, he said, you know.
That's up your street.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure, I said to myself, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ghost stories over the winter months. Grand. Uh-huh. But it actually was harder work than I thought. It was a very interesting experience, I have to say. And I didn't realise how much work. It was a bit like going into the newsroom and sort of having your eyes opened as to the amount of work that goes into compiling a news bulletin, the amount of work that goes into a book before it gets published. And that's, you know, without having been author who actually had to write the book.
And this is a question that we ask all of our guests. If there was one thing that you could change, be it in your own life or generally speaking, what would you like to change?
That's a bit of a poser, isn't it? I think in my own life, I would change some very silly decisions. And I would change, perhaps. Somebody said to me once when I was on a little bit of a rant about something that wasn't really all that important anyway, don't make unnecessary enemies. If I could, I would like to have been a bit wiser. Mm-hmm. That's all, really.
So you weren't cut out for the diplomatic corps in the end, really, were you?
Yeah, I would have been grand. But, you know, especially when you're younger, you know, you can be very hair triggerish in your response.
And you have regrets in that area?
I've had a few. I don't, Mary. There are lots of parts of my life that, looking back, weren't really the most brilliant of ideas. But they are the fabric of my life.
Correct.
And who knows what might the options have been? Mm-hmm. Look, you know, at the end of it all, you're the sum of the parts of whatever you cobbled together, limped through, sailed through, jumped through, crawled through sometimes.
Learned from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Onwards.
Yeah. Keep going. You've got a lot of your mummy in you. You might think you haven't, but you have a lot of your mummy in you.
I wish I had more.
There you go. That's what you would change. You would have more.
That would be what I would change, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a bit of the moroseness of the Doyles in me as well, you
Is
know.
That right?
A little bit too much inward looking. Mm. Hey, we are.
And, well, you are a tonic, a breath of fresh air, a woman of substance, a most loyal and kind friend. And it's been a pleasure to have you in here with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me to be here.
And a great presence in many of our lives.
A lovely thing to say. Thank you.
That wraps up today's episode of Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Well, we hope that today's episode has given you something to ponder.
And a very big thank you to our researcher, Anne-Marie Staunton, for her invaluable help.
And not forgetting our producer, Enda Grace, and the team here at Dundara Television and Media.
And to all our dedicated listeners, we are so very grateful for your support.
Don't forget to subscribe to Changing Times on your favourite podcast platform.
So from Alan Wood in County Kildare, bye for now.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.